Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 25th, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Mike Fasso.
That's right. I have acquired 50.1% in the Ania Publishing Company, and I have made some changes.
Just call me Rupert Murdoch Fasso.
Mike, it's so good to have you on the show, man.
It's good to be back.
No, people, don't worry. Scott's not having surgery like I did a few years ago. He actually, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but I've told you a lot of stories about my sports days at the Times, right, Mike?
Many, yes.
And, you know, there used to be always these breaking stories in the sports world where it was huge, huge news story. And, you know, like 4 or 5 days later, one of our hefty, overweight columnists would have to pontificate about the said news story, even though it was already 5 days old. And then I would turn to my boss and say, why is this person writing this story now? This happened 5 days ago. And then they would say, well, it hasn't been said until he has said it. So with that, I give you this clip.
Hey, guys. This is Scott from Safety Harbor, long-time listener, first-time caller. Just wanted to let you know that I will not be able to make the show the next 2 weeks, but I'm hoping the guest host that we lined up, the always entertaining Mike Fasso and the very brilliant Lee Childs, can fill my shoes admirably. Well, I mean, come on, who are we kidding? No one can really fill my shoes. But hopefully they'll do a good enough job, even mangle a word or two, that you won't miss me for the next 2 weeks. And I'll be happy to be back as soon as I can to tell you about all these crazy travels I'm doing out here in Darwin's country. Thanks a lot, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
So well, you got that? I mean, are you going to mispronounce a couple of words today to keep up the quota?
I actually listened to last week's show, and Scott said the word conglomeration, which is a word you don't hear very often, but he seemed to spit it out correctly, so that, I thought that was pretty good.
He got it right, and he used it in the right context, which is always important for Scott.
Yeah, exactly.
So hopefully next week Lee Childs will be on the show as well. Fingers crossed. You know, every month I go through this with Lee. I send him an email saying, hey, your column's due 6 days ago. And somehow he rattles one off just in time. So hopefully he'll touch base with us soon, and we'll have him on the show next week. But enough about him. You're on the show, and we missed you last week in the home game. You were out of town. What happened?
Well, this is what happened. You guys figured out when I was going to be on vacation, and you quickly scheduled a home game. I mean, what is going on with that?
We can only win when you're gone.
That's right. You guys are taking food out of my mouth because, and it's obvious what's going on because every time I go on vacation, instantly there's a home game scheduled when I can't make it. No, I was, I went up to New York for a week or so and on vacation and saw several concerts and plays and a few musicals and things like that. So I had a good time up there.
Very cool. I know you're always a big fan of the opera and stuff like that too. So, what were any of the shows worth mentioning here?
Well, I think there was for the first time I saw Jesus Christ Superstar, which has been around for years, but I've never seen it, and I thought it was terrific. I don't know if you've ever seen that, Chris.
No, but I had the soundtrack because the music was just so good.
Yeah, it's really great, you know, I saw another thing which probably will go down as the longest play in history. I was in the theater for a grand total of 8 hours, including intermissions.
Oh my God.
It was a show called Gats. G-A-T-Z, and it was a staged reading of the entire text of The Great Gatsby.
Wow.
And it wasn't just somebody reading. It actually, they went through some of the action of the book as well, and they didn't skip a word of the whole text, and that was quite a thing that I'll probably never see again, but it was good to see it at least once.
I know that they're having this Great Gatsby movie come out, and there's some sort of controversy about it, because they modernized it, kind of like what they did that Romeo and Juliet thing a few years back.
I saw the trailer, and it's got Leo DiCaprio as Jay Gatsby, yeah. And it's done by Baz Luhrmann, who did the big spectacles with Romeo and Juliet and some of those other ones. So it looks like it's going to be a little over the top, but then again, the time of the book, it was, everything was kind of over the top, so we'll see how it goes.
And Leo was in that too, right? He was in that Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah. Yep. So did you run into Worm while you were in the streets of New York?
No. I did hear a funny story, though, that Rounders, the guy who wrote it, Brian Koppelman, that somebody told me that Norm Macdonald was one of the models for that film, the comedian Norm Macdonald, and that he used to go to the Mayfair Club. And that's where they got some of the material of him being in there all night and whatnot. I don't know how true that is. I know Norm Macdonald did go to the Mayfair Club. He's a big gambler. But that's the first time I had heard that he was one of the prototypes for that film. But speaking of comedy, I did go while I was up there to several comedy clubs, including the Comedy Cellar, which is the one where they bring in several comics in rotation. And there's going to be a Betty White roast on Comedy Central. And they filmed it while I was up there at one of the ballrooms in New York. But the great thing was that Jeffrey Ross, who is the Roastmaster General,
right.
You're probably familiar
with him. He's my favorite comedian, actually.
He came in a couple nights when I was there to test out material for the Betty White roast.
Oh, that is so cool.
So he had it on his BlackBerry or whatever, and he was just going through these things. And just to give your listeners a preview, because I don't know when the Comedy Central thing is ever going to air, but he rattled off some of his Betty White material. Betty White is so old, she signed her first contract with a chisel. The color white is named after Betty White. Betty White has outlived three husbands. More people have died on top of her than Mount Everest. Betty White is so old, her tramp stamp is in Sanskrit. Anyway, he was hilarious, man. And it was a good time up there getting a preview of that roast.
All the stuff that he makes me laugh when he's on, I mean, it's just nonstop. I can't stop. It's like an automatic reaction I have once he's going. I can't stop it.
He's great.
How do you feel about comedians looking at their notes? I know this isn't about poker, but that's my job today, is to fill in for Scott telling inane stories that mean nothing to poker. So, I once saw George Carlin at my college. He came for one of our, senior year or so, I don't know what it was, but and he was just sitting there reading his notes the whole time almost, and it was kind of annoying to me. I kind of felt insulted, like we weren't important enough for him to memorize, and a lot of the stuff was classic Carlin, God rest his soul, or Darwin rest his soul, as Scott would say. But how do you feel about that? Does that bother you? I mean, with this, it was different. He was working on material and said, hey, you want to hear some funny stuff? I'll come in and read my notes to you guys. But in general, if you pay some good money to go see a specific comedian, does it bother you?
It doesn't bother me, but I think I'd rather see a polished, rehearsed performance where every line is just nailed.
Yeah.
Without going... Now, you said that Carlin was doing his classic stuff and still looking at his notes.
Yeah.
A lot of times I find that they're trying out new stuff when they're reading their notes, and I guess that's okay. But another show I saw while I was up there was basically 90 minutes of people telling jokes, and they didn't miss a beat. And so it was an off-Broadway show. It was called Old Jews Telling Jokes. And basically, it was just 90 minutes of these great old jokes. And I've got one for you that I will always remember. When you leave the show, it's one of those shows where you're like, oh my God, I've got to remember this joke, I've got to remember that joke. You wish you had a pad taking it down.
Yeah.
But here's the joke. The guy wakes up in the hospital, and the nurse tells him, sir, I'm sorry. You've been in an accident. You're going to be fine. But apparently, during the accident, your penis got caught in the door, and we had to amputate your penis. And the guy goes, oh, my God. The doctor comes in and says, look, it's going to be okay. We have a $9,000 check from the insurance company. What we can do is we can reconstitute your penis with an artificial organ. Now, what you need to do is go home and talk to your wife about how many inches you want. Now, if you have a certain length and you try to go more, it might be uncomfortable for her. Or if you're at another length and you bring it down, it might not be satisfying to her. So we need to know the length before we can do the operation. But you've got the insurance check for $9,000. So I need you to go home and talk to your wife. So he goes home. He talks to the wife. He goes back to the doctor the next day. The doctor says, have you talked to your wife? And the guy says, yes, I have. And he says, well, what are you going to get? And the guy says, granite countertops.
Oh, my God.
90 minutes of that. It was terrific.
That's so cool. And I do like that, too. I like it when they're just telling you jokes and doesn't always have to be this whole, hey, here's my life story and why it's so apparently funny, every single thing I do in life. So, but that's cool. So you're back from New York, and I'm back from Daytona and Jacksonville. I also traveled, and we'll talk a little bit more about that on the show in the main topic later on. But I'm really glad you're on this week. I actually was hoping you were on last week. Actually, I hope you're on every week, and Scott's just somehow out of the town. But last week we did, and you helped contribute to this too, we did the whole, you know, best poker scene in a non-poker movie. And of course, we thought, the first person I thought of was, you know, we should have Mike on, or we should do that show when Mike is on the show.
Well, I listened to it, and I thought it went very well.
Well, thanks. And, there were a lot of contributors, a lot of our fans and listeners and whatnot wrote in and gave us a lot of ideas. And then there's always a couple who are late to the party. I guess they wrote in post-episode to suggest Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, which was one of my favorite movies. That's Guy Ritchie, right? Isn't that Guy Ritchie?
Guy Ritchie,
yeah.
Right.
One of my favorite movies, and I can't believe I forgot it. But, you know, there's just so many, and you're searching your brain. That was a great movie, and that's a great scene. I actually watched it again last night to refresh myself. I don't have the clip here because, I just didn't get together in time. But you liked that movie, didn't you?
Well, the clip that I saw, I watched it myself again too last night, and they're not actually playing poker in that clip.
Right, it's like a three-card game or something.
It's a three-card English game. It's called Brag.
Yeah, Brag.
And I went online and tried to figure out. It actually could be a good game for our game, but it's a three-card poker game. But it's the way it was shot, I thought was very good. The movie was done in '98, and you see some of the techniques in that scene that you see now that I'm sure were very original then, such as that where you see a person walking around and the camera's attached to their body so that everything is static when they're moving around. But it was another one of these scenes where it's like, I raise, and then I'm out of money. Yeah. And that always kind of bothers me. But I thought it was very well done, and it would have like a music video feel to it. And it was a good scene, but it was not poker.
No, it wasn't. And there's two things about that I want to say. One is it was very similar to Honeymoon in Vegas, that poker scene when he gets money loaned to him by James Caan.
Right.
You know, because he knows he's set up the hand. And the other thing, too, is I really don't think that someone would risk $500,000 on a pair of sixes and brag and call with a pair of sixes. You know what I mean? To me, that was kind of weird, too. But I agree with you. That camera angle is the first thing I thought of, was like that Survivor Man show and all those reality TV shows where they have the camera hooked up to their face or their waist as they're walking around. And I'm like, oh, my God, that was totally like the first time I ever saw that.
Right.
Another movie they suggested was Bang the Drum Slowly, very similar to the Stripe scene, I guess, where they're kind of taking advantage of Robert De Niro. But I don't really recall that scene. I saw that movie probably 20 years ago.
Yeah, I saw the movie more recently than that, and I don't remember the poker scene, but it's probably one that's worth watching again because it has some early work by Robert De Niro and also one of my favorite actors in there, the guy who was in Law and Order, Michael... oh, man.
This is live podcasting, baby.
Michael Moriarty.
Oh, Moriarty. Okay, yeah. and then the other thing was The Odd Couple. Chuck wrote in, one of our longtime listeners wrote in and said, hey, you forgot about The Odd Couple, too, the original movie, The Odd Couple. So there are a couple other movies out there that have some pretty good scenes that aren't really about poker. But most of the correspondence, and I kick myself for this, too, but most of the correspondence was centered around Maverick, saying that it didn't really belong on that show because it was a poker movie. And I thought I wanted to ask you about this because, yes, he's trying to get this bankroll together to play in this big tournament at the end. And, yes, that is poker. But really, there's like two poker scenes in the movie. Other than that, he's like doing all these hijinks and fighting and trying, yeah. You know what I mean? And he's trying to woo Jodie Foster, which we all know is impossible. So, but really, what do you think? Do you think Maverick is a poker movie?
I don't class it. When I first saw that, the first thing I think of is not a poker movie. I think of it as kind of a comedic western type thing. I don't look at it as a poker movie.
Okay, so we didn't make a huge mistake by putting that on the show.
Well, you're not going to be arrested. I don't think that.
Well, speaking of being arrested or at least legal trouble, our hotline is 813-448-1120. If you call that and we use it, we'll give you something cool, although I don't know if that's going to happen this time around. Let's listen to this clip.
Hi. Yes, sir. I just seen a commercial on television about your law firm, and I was wondering if you could possibly help me. And it's concerning a fall that I had at a neighbor's home, and in the process, I missed the ladder coming out because it was on a concrete floor, and I ended up amputating. I almost died. I ended up with amputating my own middle toe on my left foot.
You would think that they would hear the message or something and be like, all right, I haven't reached the law firm of Long, Bard, and Hopper. Our motto is soothe our neighbor. that's always funny when we get calls like that. I feel bad. It's like you want to call the old person back and be like, hey, you know, you didn't call a law firm. You better check that number again. So apparently our hotline is very similar to a law firm in the Tampa area.
Yeah. Well, actually, when you think about it, it is kind of a poker related issue because of the amputation. I guess you could say she was in the cutoff.
Oh, that's so mad. That is so nasty, man. But really, let's assume that you know, Scott has a home game, and you know, we go there, and then you fall down. You know, one of his cats gets in the way. And you trip over one, and you have to amputate your leg because of the result of falling over one of his cats. All right, would you ever consider suing Scott?
Probably not Scott. You, yes.
Yeah, me. That's why I don't host him. Don't you understand? I have not hosted a home game in 7 years.
The liability issues are just too steep.
I don't have any animals running around the house that can, you know, make you trip and fall. But
other,
you know,
than rugrats.
Yeah. That's true. Oh, man. So we're sorry that you called our hotline looking for some legal advice. I'd sue him, but, you know, that's just me. But if you do call our hotline, 813-448-1120, we'll give you some really cool swag from our swag shelf, like a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Annie Up, and you can pick up your own decks at the Annie Up store at annieupstore.com. Well, Mike, we got a mailbag here. I'm hoping that you can shed some light on this. We like to revisit this topic every once in a while, and it's pretty important. And we just mentioned the home game, so why don't you get us started?
Yeah, this is from Ron Grant, and he's asking about tips on starting a home game. And he writes, I've been listening to your podcast for about a year now and enjoy it a lot. I live in the poker desert of North Carolina. The only casino in the state does not deal cards. There was talk of legislation to allow this, but we are still waiting. I hear you talk about your home game. I was wondering if you had any advice on how to find a group or how to get a home game started. I'm a bit leery about sitting down in a non-casino setting with a group I don't know. So what are some of the things to look for? Finally, what are the laws around home games?
Well, I know you have the first thing I want to say real quick was that when he says the state does not deal cards, or the casino in the state doesn't, I think what he's getting at there is that it's not actual cards because the Cherokee does have poker. They just have electronic tables and deal poker there. So they do have poker there. It's just not the actual card. So, but I know you've got some thoughts on this.
Well, the first thing I would say is you should always make sure that the strongest player is out of town when you set up your home game, because Chris will tell you that that's the way they do it here. I would only play, first of all, with people that you know and trust. I know there are a lot of pickup type situations on the online where you can get games going, but basically, I think, and I'll speak for our game, I think we have two tiers of players in our game. The top tier, and I don't mean this top as being better, but it's the people who host the games.
Right.
And then we have a second tier of people who will come to the games. And basically, you want those top people to be people that if you had a kid, you would let them babysit your kid. And probably the bottom tier as well. But these ought to be all people you know and trust. And I'll just give you one piece of advice. If you have a game and someone comes into it who you don't know that well, and you see something you don't care for or whatever, you have to be very brutal and just cut that person out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. Just end it. Don't invite that person back. Don't allow a bad situation to continue. And you know, there are situations where people are uncomfortable with other people, and for the good of the game, sometimes a person needs to be cut out of a game for that reason. And I just think you need to be very stern about who you'll play with and make sure they're people you know and trust. I wouldn't go into a game myself with six or seven other people that I didn't know, just met online, not in a million years.
I find it ironic that you've brought this up, because this is the chance for me to let you know that's why you were invited to the No, well, the other thing too is he asks about legality of it, but before I say that, you know, our home game is a good example of how maybe Ron should try this. Is we really all knew each other from work to start.
Yeah,
you know, Scott, you, me, and then a couple of the other people in the beginning when we were doing like sit and goes and stuff, we weren't really playing a lot of cash games. And then as we grew, and then our show grew, and we got some of our listeners like Gambit and Dr. Frank to come along, then that's how the game sort of picked up, and we had more players and a bigger pool to choose from. So maybe Ron, maybe, you know, just talk to your buddies at work if you do work in a public setting and not from home or something. And just say, hey, bend some guy's ears and say, you guys play poker? You know anybody who plays poker? Because at least you can start that way. Maybe they don't play poker, but they know someone who plays poker, and then they could vouch for them. That's one way to do it without having to be total strangers. At least it's like once removed or something. So that's another way to try to get a home game going. But when he asks about the legality of home games, I did look up the North Carolina law, and it says home poker games are not legal in North Carolina. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't have a home game. I'm just telling you what it says. The state statutes provide legalization of state-approved lotteries, gaming, bingo, and raffles, outlawing all other forms of gambling. Chapter 14-292 states that any person who plays at or bets in any game at which any money, property, or other thing of value is bet, whether the same be in stake or not, shall be guilty of a Class 2 misdemeanor. So, not exactly the worst thing you could be charged with in the world, but, you know, it's a home game. If you're friends and trusted friends or whatever, you know, that gets back to what Mike was saying, that if you trust everybody, you know, you're not going to have some undercover cop in your game or whatever. And, you know, some states allow for like a pool of $10 or something is the largest bet or whatever it is. So it just depends on where you are. But unfortunately, in North Carolina, they just do not like gambling there.
What do you think, Chris, about playing with relatives? You do that quite a bit.
Yeah, I find that I won't play for money with relatives. One, because you just everybody always says, "Oh my God, if my grandma was sitting across from me and I check raise her for all of her life savings." No, I don't think you would, to be honest. When you're sitting there with your mom and your dad and they want to play for a few bucks or whatever, you just don't feel good when you take their money. And when you go home, and then you give their money back, but you know they would take your money because, so it's tough. I don't really enjoy playing against family. Friends is another thing. I learned a lesson early on in our home game, and then I've taken it to heart that I still want it to be friendly, even if we are joking around or zinging each other or whatever. I still want, and I'll take everybody's money if I can in the home game because we're all grown men and we all have jobs and we know what we can and can't afford to do. So in that situation, it's one thing. But when you're at your family's house, it's totally different. I don't think you would play against your family, would you?
Not probably for fake money or something.
Yeah, just for fun.
And then in our game, as far as taking friends' money, with the buy-ins that we have, no one is going to miss a car payment or mortgage payment on one bad night, so it's not an issue really.
Right. All right. Well, Ron, thanks for writing in, and I want to let you know that you have won a download of the Chinese 13 card poker app for the Apple products from Smapsoft. You don't have to be a winner to enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes Store. Hey, we got another Call to Floor this week. The Call to Floor is becoming more and more popular. It's remarkable how many people write in with situations. It just goes to show you that's why everybody always says it depends when they ask a question in poker, because there are just so many different situations that can happen.
Yep. Well, this one's from Tony in Philadelphia, and he says, "I got involved in a hand with another big stack where after going to showdown, I took more than half of his chips. At the time, the tournament rule was that recently seeded players had to wait for the button to pass in order to play. A recently seeded player was incorrectly dealt into the hand above and folded on the flop. On the next hand, he was dealt in again, but this time someone noticed. The player I had just beaten called the floor and argued that he should get his chips back because the previous hand was a misdeal because of the inclusion of the new arrival. What's the right ruling? Would the answer be different if he had noticed it during the original hand, after showdown, but before the pot was pushed to me?"
Wow, that's pretty crazy. Okay, well, here's Jody. Jody says, "The number one rule in poker is it's every player's responsibility to protect their hand, which includes, but is not limited to, the right to act, what the action is, where the action is, and even knowing that everyone dealt in has the right to have a hand. The right to dispute an incorrect player having a hand ended once substantial action occurred, which is TDA Rule 32. Had this been caught before action occurred, there shouldn't have been a misdeal. The incorrectly dealt hand would have been killed, and play would begin. Though the order of the cards changed, they were all random. It isn't about everyone having the exact two cards from the deck the universe intended them to have. It's about making sure the players who get to act in the hand have a right to do so. The result of the hand would have been the same. If this were noticed after showdown, but before the chips were pushed, the correct ruling would have been there was substantial action in the hand, so the action stands. This is addressed in TDA Rule 18, Disputed Pots. The right to dispute a hand ends when a new hand begins. TDA Rule 31, Misdeals, states in the last sentence that a misdeal cannot be declared once substantial action occurs." Pretty interesting stuff, and it makes sense because that's generally the rule with everything. Once substantial action happens, money's in the middle and, pots have gotten pulled in and you have to recreate it and go to the eye in the sky. And really, you got to do what's best for the game,
Yeah. I think that the substantial action part of this is something that shows up in a lot of these, is it not?
Yeah. Yep. And it's even a lot of stuff that's a lot of contention, too. Like, even when we had Nick on the show before, he had been to the actual TDA summit, and substantial action was one of the larger topics that they discussed out there and took like days to discuss. So yeah, substantial action is always a room for interpretation too. So,
and I will also say this: call the floor does not mean that nine people start yelling at the dealer and the floor. Call the floor means call the floor, let the floor and the dealer sort it out, and everybody else shut up. How about we do that?
That's pretty funny, and something like that happened this week. And I wanted to get your opinion on it. And we'll talk about that later on, the main things that happened in the tournament I was in. But I think I will maybe even ask Jody and do it on the show once, because it was something that was interesting. I'm glad that he wrote in, and of course the swag shelf is open to you. You get a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Annie Up store at annieupstore.com. See, now when I read it just like Scott says it, then they know it's scripted. Maybe I should sort of read these things a little differently, so it's sort of off the cuff. I don't know. But I don't know. You said you listened to last week's show, right?
Yes.
So did you catch this segment about stereotyping players?
Yeah.
What did you think about that?
I thought Scott made some good points. That all stereotypes have some kernel of truth in them, uh-huh. otherwise they wouldn't exist.
Right.
And B, that you need to actually observe something to base your action on it. You can't just sit down, see a person who is a certain type of person, and then automatically assume that that person's going to act in a certain way at the poker table. So I think he hit it right on the head there.
Yeah, and I remember the incident, too. I don't think I could have gotten away from those kings, but he just said, you know what, he seems like an older gentleman who might be tight. I'm letting go, and the guy had aces, and it was a good fold.
Well, I was at my last trip out to Vegas last year, I think it was. I was playing at, it doesn't matter where it was. It could have been Monte Carlo, for all I care. But it was a 1-2 no-limit game,
right.
And I was dealt under-the-gun queens. So I made it 8 or whatever the standard raise was. When it got back to the small blind made it 30.
Oof.
Right?
Yeah.
I thought for a minute, and I mucked the queens. Now, this was an old guy. I had been there a while. He was tighter than I am, which is very hard to do. He showed me two aces.
Wow.
So, and within an hour, I had folded queens twice in similar situations, and both times I was right. Now, I'm a nit, we all know that, but that was a case where I actually had picked up on something, and then I confirmed the stereotype, so I went ahead and acted on it.
Have you ever folded aces preflop?
I don't think I've ever done that.
I've done it twice.
Yeah.
Both times.
Well, I could see it. In a running up the in a bubble situation, I could see myself doing it very easily.
I did it online because they used to have the shortcut thing where you could bet a dollar, and the button above it was fold. And I went to hit the one, and I hit the F1, and it folded my pocket aces. And I did that twice in my life. I was just nauseous after that. Oh my god, I was so sick. But anyway, I brought up the stereotyping thing because our feedback this week comes from Martha Patella, also known as Thitza. You remember Martha from the cruise?
Oh, right. Sure.
Yeah, she was so excited to meet you. She was like, oh, my God, I'm standing so fast, so I didn't even know it. And I was like, yeah, that's Mike Faso. She goes, oh, my God. So she's a great, great person. A lot of fun to play with.
Oh, she's
and,
a ball.
She wrote in. She said, please, guys, please encourage your listeners and their friends to continue to stereotype in poker. I fall into two stereotypes. So as an older woman, you all know I must have a huge hand when I raise under the gun or on the button, 3-bet from the big blind, or lead into you on the flop. Of course, I will prove that to you during the first half hour or hour I sit at your table when I only show you the nuts. So you are absolutely correct in stereotyping me. Please continue to do so I can keep making money.
I'm guilty of that. I'm guilty of sitting at a table and folding to just about any bet from an older lady if I see that she's has a history of showing down big hands.
It's so funny because all these items now are leading up to stuff that actually happened to me in the tournament. So I won't get to the main event, the main topic. I mean, I'm going to be talking about this as well because there was a lady that was basically, she wasn't older or anything, but she fit one of these things. So I'm going to talk about that later. So it's pretty cool that all this stuff is lining up. Yep. See what happens when you get out and actually play? Things actually happen to you.
Yeah, you actually see stuff.
Oh, my God. All right, well, my meetup has come and gone, but there are a few more coming. This week alone, Scott is going to be in Minneapolis on the 27th at a St. Paul Saints minor league baseball game at 3 p.m. He's telling everybody here to buy a general admission ticket and find us in the general admission section, and he will tweet the location on our Twitter feed, at Annie Up Magazine. He said then there's going to be a cash game at Canterbury Park at 7:30 p.m. Then a couple of days later, on the 29th, he's in Chicago. They're going to have another cash game at the Horseshoe Hammond at 8 o'clock. Then Scott and I will both be in Vegas. I can't remember now. Are you going to be in Vegas when we're going to be there?
I'll be there the week afterwards.
The week after. Okay, so we'll miss you. But on the 27th of June, we're going to be crashing the 6-12 mix game that Karina Jett is always touting on Twitter at 6 p.m. at the MGM Grand. And then we'll likely get a table with something else going if people don't want to play that or play that level or whatever. But that's going to be a meetup, you know, just a casual thing. Apparently, Scott is also going to continue after our trip, and he'll be going to New Mexico on June 30th. And if there's interest there, they'll have a cash game at one of those casinos. As it gets closer, we'll try to narrow that down. And then right after that, he's going to be at the Isle Blackhawk in Colorado on July 1st or 2nd. Same thing, cash game. Let us know if you're interested, and he'll be there. And, you know, the cruises are... We've got a bunch of people coming on our next cruise already. We're near 200 already.
That's great.
Yeah, it's sick. It's if you want to check out our schedule, it's at AnnieUpMagazine.com/cruise. But the next one we talked about, August 27th out of Port Canaveral, we have giveaways now at Suncoast in Las Vegas, Palm Beach Kennel Club, Hard Rock Hollywood, Tampa Bay Downs, and Ebro Greyhound Park. Yes, a lot of them are in Florida, but a lot of our listeners are here too. And, I mean, literally, Palm Beach Kennel Club is like 40 packages they're giving away. It's just insane. So we're very excited, very happy that they're doing all that for us. And our final cruise of the year will be November 10th out of Baltimore. And we actually have some giveaways for that already, too, planned at Dover Downs in Hotel and Casino in Delaware. So doing some good things there with those giveaways.
And I will say this. There won't be a meetup, but if anyone's in Las Vegas the first week of July, I will be... playing on July 3rd, which is a Tuesday, in the Binion's Poker Classic, the $200 horse.
Awesome.
On July 3rd. So if you see me there, and if you're an Annie Up person, come over and say hello. And if I do well out there, I may also play in the July 5th Binion's $200 PLO 8.
Awesome. And if you don't know what Fassel looks like, just look for David Sklansky. without glasses. All right, Mike, why don't you get us started? A lot of stuff happened this week on our Annie Up news desk.
Yeah, the White House has finally responded to a petition about online poker, but players looking for a clear direction from the Obama administration will be disappointed. The four-paragraph response essentially says states are free to regulate online gaming as they see fit, and the administration will continue to study the issue to see whether it's possible to prevent minors from playing online and whether money laundering can be stopped as well.
Yeah, you know, first of all, you can find that the whole letter on our website, AnnieUpMagazine.com, in our news section. You can read the whole thing. It's essentially what we just said here. But, you know, other countries have these regulations in place that are keeping minors from playing.
Yeah.
What is it? We're America. Shouldn't we be able to, you know what I mean? It's ridiculous. It's just getting ridiculous.
Well, it's the same. I can't understand why on so many issues, and poker is one, and there are others that are more of a political nature that I won't discuss, that other countries seem to have figured out how to get this stuff done, but yet we have to start everything from scratch and can't seem to figure it out.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, is it's just everyone has a handout, and that's the thing.
Yeah.
And lobbyists are like the devil. You know, it's the worst thing possible, and it's just crazy. But and it's like, also, when you think about it, you ever have one of those sessions where you do, the timing is wrong on everything you do? When you slow play the maniac, he doesn't have a hand. When you, you know, when you fold the borderline hand, you would have flopped a flush or a straight.
Yeah,
it's the same thing with this, it seems. It's like every time we get to momentum, now it's an election year, and he doesn't want to touch it during an election year.
Yeah.
So if Obama wins, then maybe in the first year or the second year, he might, you know, he might force them to get involved or something. But really, it just seems like no matter what we do with this, we have that bad timing.
Yeah.
Absolutely brutal. All right, Wicked Chops has reported that All In Productions, the creator of the Heartland Poker Tour, has made a bid to bankruptcy court to buy back the tour from Federated Sports and Gaming, which filed for bankruptcy protection this year. All In sold the tour to Federated for $1.9 million, but received little of the money before the bankruptcy filing. It now wants to pay $1.5 million to buy the tour back, plus the usable assets of Federated. So this basically means that it's just going to be a wash. When they say they want to buy it back, they're saying, we'll forgive the $1.5 million you didn't pay us, and just give us back our tour, right? That's essentially what they're saying here, I think.
Yeah.
And I think they want that global index. That's one of the assets that they're talking about, too. But okay, and finally, Shut Up and Fold, a new comic book chronicling the adventures of 9 poker players, is due to be released very soon. What do you think about this? They're going to have, like, you know for sure there's going to be a lot of hero calls in this thing, I would say.
Well, I can think of a comic book hero based on me that I could put up there for the new book. It would be called Knitman. He would be like squeezing his chips very tightly, and you'd have to like use a crowbar to get them out of his hand or something.
And his bankroll would be forged from the diamonds that he could put in his hand and squeezes so tight that any carbon-based chips would be turned into diamonds.
Exactly. That's it. And you would be Volcano Man.
You know, I got this reputation of erupting. I don't know what the deal is. I have gotten some of the worst beats ever in our home game, and I have handled it much better than I have in the past. Have I not?
Well, notice you said you've handled it much better. You didn't say you've handled it with class.
I didn't want to go there. We were talking about Binions and Vegas. I didn't want to go there.
I will say this. You don't throw cards anymore. Did you ever throw cards?
No. That's you.
Oh, that's me. That's right.
I don't throw cards.
You're all right. You just your voice gets so high, and it just the eruptions are so. It's fun to watch.
Oh my God. Well, you know, I won in the home game when you weren't there, so maybe you're the key to everything. I don't know, but I do win when you're there too. So you win when I'm there. So I don't know, but you know, it's just why have a home game and not have personalities, right? If we're all sitting there. Monotone, monosyllabic idiots, then it's no fun
that way. You're right.
All right, we're going to play a first part of an O'Malley's move, but what we're going to do is we're going to wait until Scott gets back to wrap it up. So next week there won't be an O'Malley's move, and then the week after we'll conclude it. So here comes part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we are sitting at a 2-5 no-limit hold'em cash game. There are 9 people at the table, and since it's a bit higher stakes, you get a few more solid players in the game. We sit with 850 and have been playing for about an hour. The under-the-gun min raises to 10. He's at that awkward poker age, where he's past the level of any two cards, but not quite to a solid level yet. He understands the game, but it's just a fledgling understanding. And he's prone to make mistakes. We've gleaned this information while talking with him in the lounge, waiting to be called to the table. He sits with $600. The +1 and +2 call, MP1 folds, but the MPs 2 and 3 call, and we're in the cutoff with the Jack of Diamonds, 9 of Diamonds. Not the greatest starting hand in the world, but there's already $57 in the pot, so we're getting 5.7 to 1 on our money. We toss in the $10 to see if we can hit a flop. The button folds, as does the small blind, and the big blind calls. The pot is $70, and we see a flop of Queen of Diamonds, 9 of Clubs, 2 of Spades. Okay, we've seen better flops than this before. The big blind checks, and the initial raiser makes it $25 to go. The +1 and +2 fold. MP2 calls, and the MP3 folds. It's $25 to win $120. That's not bad. We haven't got much here, so we're going to float. We make the call, giving us 815 behind. The big blind folds. The turn is the 10 of diamonds. We have a pair and an open-ended straight flush draw. The under the gun leads out for 100 into the $145 pot. The MP folds, and it's to us. What are we going to do?
Well, Mike, you know, it's awesome to have you on the show. You hadn't been on in a while, and, you know, people always look for you to, you know, do your dramatic readings and all that stuff. But what they really like is just to hear your perspective. I think they respect your poker game, and they like to hear what you have to say about things. So when we're talking today now during the main topic, I'll have a couple of hands and stuff that happened to me, and I'd like to know how that happened to you. But have you been playing a lot lately other than just with us?
I have a confession to make, Chris.
Uh-oh.
I haven't played a single hand of poker since the poker cruise.
Really?
Yeah. And speaking of that poker cruise, I must have missed an issue or something. Shouldn't there have been a cover story about me finishing first in the Annie Up tournament? I mean, I didn't even get mentioned in the thing. I didn't get any photographic coverage. I won a tournament, Chris.
You chopped one. There's a difference between chopping and winning.
And I was going to do an every hand revealed type of thing on the tournament. But then you pointed out to me, I was getting a little ahead of myself, I guess. And then you pointed out it was 29 people. It was a four table tournament. It just seemed so much bigger than that. It really did.
Yeah. You know, we're sitting there at dinner and he's just going on and on about how he won this tournament. And every time I come on a cruise, I seem to do well in cash at your events. And he's like, I'm thinking about maybe even writing a story. And I'm like, Mike, you didn't cure cancer. You beat 27 people, okay? Because you didn't even beat 28 because you chopped the damn thing. All right? Let's just call a spade, okay? You won a single, for God's sakes.
Well, I do have one little poker thing, though, from that tournament that I found useful. The guy I chopped with is a tremendous player of tournaments. I think – I'm not sure, but just about everything he sat down at, he got a piece of that on that cruise. He was very aggressive, and I figured out that the way for me to climb up the ladder and try to get into the money and get to the later stages, I had him at my table, and I basically, when I saw how he was playing, I said the only way I'm really going to get a big stack here is if I can trap him. And because I'm not an aggressive player, I don't splash around a lot. I'm more of a trappy type player. So I ended up limping in with kings in middle position. He was in one of the blinds. As I suspected, he popped it. And I just smooth called. The flop came out jack high. He led out. I raised. He re-popped me, and then we got it all in. He had me covered by so much.
Right.
He ended up having something like ace-jack. He had flopped top-top. My kings held up. I doubled my stack, and basically I rode that through to the final table where I basically just climbed up the ladder like I do. But I had to make the one move. I picked the guy that I wanted to make it against. I found the right position, and I pulled the trigger, and that was how I got it. So he was a tremendous player, though, and he was in like 80% of the hands. It seemed like he was just so active, and he had a gigantic chip stack when we got down to heads up, and he immediately offered me a chop, and of course I took it like a half a second later.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of respect for that guy, but on the other hand, it was pretty obvious his style, and I just had to take advantage of it, and that's really the only hand that I can talk about where I did anything worthwhile.
His name was Frank, and it's not Doc Frank, although he did finish third in that event as well. Frank has been in our magazine numerous times for winning numerous tournaments down at Immokalee and elsewhere. Seminole Immokalee, and he's a real good guy. And I remember the first time I played him too. We played in cash games together, and I thought, man, this guy is not good. And because I thought, you know, he was in so many hands and stuff.
Right.
That's his game. And yeah. I didn't recognize it right away. And it's funny, the last time I was at Immokalee, I was down there for the Scotty Wynn tournament. And I had gone pretty deep. There were a few hundred people in this tournament. And it was like 30 players left or so, 35. And I had pocket tens and was short and got it all in. He called me with queens, and I was screwed. So he actually knocked me out of a tournament. So I have a little history with him as well. He's been on a couple of our cruises and has always done well. And you were smart to play him that way, because that is his game, is to be real aggressive. And once he has the big stack, you're screwed.
Yeah.
Because even if he's wrong, it doesn't hurt him. And right, he's just so right. aggressive, and you have to have a hand to beat him. So, yeah, he's a real good player.
Yep.
But I did have the fortune of going across the state this week to play in the Daytona Beach Kennel Club's Deep Stack Charity Classic. We've been associated with this now for 3 years. It's always a very well-run event for a very affordable price, and I keep telling them, you guys, you gotta boost it a little bit. You know, you gotta boost the buy-in a little bit, because no one's gonna blink an eye. I mean, if you pre-registered, I think it was $150. And then if it was like a week before, it was like $175, and then it was the day of, it was like $190. But I mean, and even then, he was like, I was so nervous to get. I was talking to the rabbi who runs this charity, and it was a really good time. And they got a lot of big names to show up for it, like they do every year. They try to get some people, and we were instrumental in getting a couple of them. But Annie Duke, Ali Najad, Chris Moneymaker, who was on our cover this month, and Norman Chad.
Uh-huh.
All four of them had shown up, and I guess some of them had been there during the week as well for some of the undercard things. But they always start the main event day off by signing autographs. So here I am lugging two boxes of our most recent issue over there for Moneymaker to sign, because he's on the cover, and that's always nice. That's a lot of fun seeing, you know, these pros, these world famous people, and a world champion taking our magazine and signing it, and for the players, and you see them all standing in line with our magazine, and that was really cool. Something really funny happened. Norman Chad, he was there signing, and they were very gracious. Every time there was a photo, someone asked for a photo, they stood up, and you got to figure 600 people, more than 600 people entered this event. So that's a lot of people asking for autographs and photos and stuff. So they were very gracious and did a really nice job of placating everybody. And but Norman Chad signed autographs, and then at our table, by the way, we were 11-handed in this tournament, and we were not cramped. I don't know if it's the chairs were smaller, the tables were bigger, or what, but I had plenty of room, and I think everyone at the table had plenty of room. I even talked to a couple people. I was like, hey, you know, it's pretty amazing we're sitting 11-handed, isn't it? And they're like, yeah, I can't believe it. I don't feel tight at all. So, but the tournament was 11-handed, and we had a seat open for a while, and the pros hadn't sat down yet, and I'm like, uh-oh, I think we're going to have a pro at the table. And then here comes Norman Chad, and I'm like, oh my God, Norman Chad's going to sit at my table. This is going to be hilarious. He's like one of my, you know, poker broadcasting heroes. He's hilarious to me, and I could talk to him about some other stuff and whatever. And no, he comes by with like a gift basket, and he's like, he's actually just helping with giving stuff away, and he wasn't going to play. And I thought, oh my God, how is Norman Chad not going to play? So he gets on the mic, and he says, you know, I just want to let everybody know that I'm just going to go table to table and pay my money and avoid the middleman. And so he didn't play. I was kind of disappointed. I thought he was going to play. I mean, he's notorious for playing. I mean, obviously he likes to play stud or hose or shoe or something, but I really thought that he would sit down. It's a charity event, you know. I thought he would sit down and play, and he didn't. Instead, he kind of just went around the room and helped give away prizes and make people laugh and stuff. But the other three played. Ali and Moneymaker were knocked out fairly early, and Annie Duke made the final table, finished seventh, and actually gave back to the charity, so that was a pretty good thing. Also, Moneymaker, I have a hand of the week with Moneymaker that we'll use a little later on the show, so that's going to be pretty good. I'm going to put you on the spot. But like I said, it was a great turnout, and I have to admit, I should have won this thing. I should have at least cashed, and I was just sick about it. I mean, I didn't lose any sleep over it or anything. That's another whole issue. But there was a hand. I have to tell you this. So you start with 10,000. Well, you start with six, but you get the add-on, and you start with 10,000 chips. And I was hovering around between 9 and like 13 for the first couple of hours. I just couldn't really get much going. And then all of a sudden, I got it to 18 before our first break. And then I went on a wicked tear where I either picked up a really big hand and someone picked up a modestly big hand and we got it all in on a small flop. And I went from 18 to 30,000 to 43,000 in like a span of like, I don't know, like four hands. All of a sudden, literally after 2 hours, I'm not only the massive chip leader at my table, but probably one of the tournament chip leaders. So at that point, I pick up Jack 10 of diamonds and I'm on the button. And the blinds are relatively small still. I mean, especially my stack, they're definitely small. It was a good structure. It was like 25-minute blinds. And they had a lot of levels. And they didn't have antes until 100 was the ante. So it was like 500, 1,000 with 100 ante or whatever. So you didn't have the 100 ante for a while. You know. So the quarters weren't even used for ante. So there was some slow play, so that was pretty good. So anyway, I get into this hand. It gets limped and limped and limped. And then I think somebody like min raises. So I know there's going to be a bunch of callers, and I'm in position with suited connectors, and I'm feeling really good because, like I just said, within the last four or five hands, I went from 18,000 to 43,000, and I knocked out two players. So I was like, wow, I'm going to play this hand. It's one of my favorite hands, and I know it's your favorite hand. And so I'm going to call. So I called the min raise. A guy under the gun who had limped calls, and then two other people call. So we're like five or six hands into the flop. And I have Jack 10 of diamonds, and the flop comes 7 of diamonds, or I'm sorry, Jack of clubs, 8 of diamonds, 9 of diamonds. So I have top pair, straight, open-ended, straight, flush draw, right? So yeah. I'm like, oh my God. I mean, this is a huge flop. So the guy who initially was under the gun and limped checks. And it check, and it gets to the guy who min raised, and now he makes a really paltry bet. Like, let's say there were 10 big bets in there. He makes it like a 2 big bet.
Right.
So I raise because I'm thinking that if somebody has a better jack than me, and I just call and they call along, I want to try to get this better jack out if I can. I got a massive hand here, but at the same time, I'm thinking that I'm going to get at least one more caller if I raise. This guy has an overpair. I really don't care, really, because at that point, I'm at least a 49-51 dog, or even a favorite, or coin flip, whatever. So I raise it like, I don't know, like 5 what he bet, or 3 what he bet. So now, the under-the-gun guy who had limped raises me, min, the amount that I just raised. So it folds all the way around to me, and I ask him how much. What's
okay,
that?
Okay, so the guy who was the min raiser
gets out.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's me and this under the gun limper who now has now check raised my re-raise. So I look at his stack and I'm like, how much do you have? Now I have to admit, this is a charity event, so a couple of things, and there's another dilemma that I have to talk about too. But it was really loud because everybody's having a good time. You know, most poker tournaments, it's not really loud in the poker room. You'll hear chips clanking and shuffling, but really, for the most part, it's not really loud. Well, this was, we had a table next to us that four or five people knew each other and they weren't poker players, so they were just having a party. So it was really loud. So I looked at his chip stack and I was like, how much do you have left? And he's kind of counting it down and I'm kind of looking at it and I thought he said 12,000. But it was not 12,000. It was like 23,000.
Oh, God.
Or something. But when I looked at his stack, it looked, and I had a ton of the orange chips, which were 5,000. So even I looked at his stack, I'm like, even if I'm wrong, I've still got like 20,000 left here. I'm thinking that.
Right.
So he, when he says what he has, I look down at my cards again, look at my stack, and I'm like, all right, I'm all in. And he looks at me and goes, all right, I call. And I'm like, all right, well, even if he calls, if he has a nut flush draw, I can still win with my jacks if it doesn't get there and I have his outs in my hand. If he has a better jack than me, I can still win with any 10 and any straight card that gets there, plus any diamond. So I'm like, I don't really care what he has, but I thought I could push him off his hand. And he turns over ace-jack, and he had top-top. like right. the hand you were discussing a minute ago. So he doesn't have the flush draw, but he has top pair. And I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, I can't believe this guy called with one pair. I mean, I played it like I had a set or at least had him crushed, and he called me with one pair. And I just thought, oh my God, did I make a mistake in this hand? Should I have not put this guy all in? Should I have just called when the other guy min-raised? What would you have done in my situation?
Well,
and I know you're tight, so that's fine, but I'm looking for a different perspective on this hand.
You don't know how tight I am.
You would have folded it pre-flop?
I would have folded it pre-flop.
Okay.
Here's the reason. I'm going to have to... first, you got a couple limpers. Then you've got a min raiser. And then you're the button.
Right.
That's just too much... activity for me to play that. If I'm playing that, I want to be first in with a raise or something like that. Or I want to be the first raiser. I don't want to be calling a raise. And I don't want to be limping in necessarily. Because there's no the nut straight you can make, but you can't make the nut flush, and any overpairs you're gonna be in trouble. So I don't like that position to play that hand after there's been a couple limpers and then a raise and then it gets to me. I just probably would just pass on that hand. However, once the flop comes out, I honestly don't know how you could have gotten away from that. If I'm holding that hand and that flop comes out, there is no way I'm ever folding that hand.
Right.
So I don't think you... I can't really fault you there. You did do the raise on the flop. When the guy min-raises me after checking, I'm then thinking, well, he's got the made straight already.
Right.
At least... or a set. But even then, as you say, there's no way you can get away from that hand. There's just too much out there to there's too many outs.
And then from his standpoint, like you just said, the made straight could be out there. How does he like not think that I could have the made straight as well, or a set, or, you know, the same hand as him? Does he really want to be and he put his entire tournament life on the line to with one pair?
Yeah.
Whereas
I
didn't
have
to. It's
a charity tournament, so.
No, I know. So that was a couple other dilemmas that happened. So anyway, to make long story short, I didn't make my hand, and I went from 18,000 to 30,000 to 43,000 to 16,000 in a span of like six hands.
Yeah.
And if I'd won that, I'd have been overwhelmingly the entire tournament chip leader at that point.
Yeah.
There was nobody who had 75,000 chips. There was just nobody. I mean, I got up during the breaks and walked around, and I mean, it would have been insane, and I would have taken it deep, because every year I play in this thing, I cashed once and took it deep another year. I just know that I would have at least cashed in this event. There were only like 100 people left at that time, and it was paying like 60. So there was no way that I wasn't going to cash.
I am known as being tight, but I will say this. I think there's a lot of validity to – I think it was Chris Ferguson playing the strong style.
Right.
Where you never come in unless you're coming in for a raise,
right?
And I did that pretty much on the cruise tournament as well.
Now that's when you're entering the pot first, though, right? I mean, he's known for calling raises in position. That's what I was thinking too. Is I had suited connectors in position, and I knew it was a min raise, so I knew if I called. Plus, I got this huge stack now.
And
that's the way I like to play. And I figured the other limpers weren't going to go away for a min raise because it was only one more bet to them. So then I would have the proper odds to play this kind of hand too,
right.
And that was my
thinking.
But if
you're playing that hand, why wouldn't you come in for a three bet?
I just felt like, one, an under the gun limper, anything could have happened there, and I thought, I'm in position, and here's the thing, is I didn't want to get shut out of the hand. If the guy who min-raised had like aces or whatever, and I've opened up the betting again, and then it gets back to him, and now he can shove on me, now I've lost a three bet to this guy with Jack 10. Because I can't call his shove pre-flop with Jack 10. So I didn't want to open up the betting again. I thought if I would just call in position with the right pot odds, get the right flop, and crack one of these guys. And it turned out that I got exactly what I wanted, essentially.
Right.
I just didn't get the result I wanted. So But then right after that hand, an interesting incident happened. And this is something that I'll probably talk to Jody about, maybe have it as a call-to-floor thing. So there's a woman to my left, and she this segues right into her later, but she we're at the stage now where people could be making bets of 1,200 or 12,000, okay?
Right.
And she was in the number one seat, and we had a lot of aggressive players who were they thought quickly, and so they acted quickly, and they were on her left. So she's under the gun. I'm in the blinds, and she raises to 12, and that's what she says.
12.
And she goes, raise 12, and she's fondling her chips, getting ready to throw them in, and it goes fold, fold, and gets to another guy who's really quick, and he's about to call when she throws out 12,000. And a normal raise would have been 1,200.
Yeah.
But she meant 12,000. And she said, raise, she goes 12, and she's like getting the chips in her hand, getting ready to throw them out, but it could have very easily been grabbing 1,200. And this guy who acts very quickly almost called, but thinking he was calling 1,200. And when he saw the 12,000, he almost literally took the money and went across the line with it with 1,200 to call quickly. Then he saw 12,000, and he was like, whoa, you raised 12,000? And she's like, yep. Now, really, 12,000 was like 13 times the big blind. It was just right. Huge, whatever it was. No, it was like way more than that. It was like 30 times the big blind, because like 1,200 would have been a legitimate raise. So we were wondering if this guy had called because she only said 12, and he was thinking it was 1,200, and he throws his 1,200 out, then she actually gets around to getting the 12,000 out there. What would have happened? And then there's other things where, you know, people have a speech impediment, they speak slowly, you didn't hear the 1,000 part, and she said 12,000, but you didn't hear it, or she said 12K, or some weird way of saying it. And I was just thinking, what would have happened had he thrown that 1,200 out there and she threw 12,000 at the same time? Because as soon as she said raise 12, it went full fold, and the guy like grabbed 1,200, and before she could even say 1,000, he was like literally grabbing his 1,200 and calling.
Hmm.
And then she said 1,000 and let it go. And it's like, okay, she has the right to act however slowly or quickly she wants to act, but in this case, does this guy get screwed if he had thrown that 1,200 out there? Does the 1,200 have to stay? Can he pull it back? It was a real weird situation that I guess we'd all joked about it when somebody says 12 and we all know you mean 1,200 and mm-hmm. laugh and say, oh, did you mean 12 or 12,000 and giggle about it. But in this case, it almost happened. What do you think should have happened there?
I mean, Jody would be the one to answer that. I would say that, wow.
I mean, has that ever happened to you? Have you ever seen that?
I've seen where people have thrown stuff out in a cash game, and then they've, where they thought they were calling, and it actually had been raised, and where they have to, that money now stays in the pot.
Yeah,
I don't know if that would be the same situation here or not. I mean, they're not obligated to call the raise, but they were obligated to, once they threw the money in, that it couldn't come back out. I don't know if that applies in tournaments or not.
I think the 1,200 has to stay out there, because I think we go back to our call to floor today when he says the number one rule is to keep track of all the action, and if you're not aware of what the raise is, whether she said 12 or not, you need to clarify with the dealer. And I think it's a little fault on the dealer's end too, because he needs to make sure that she's making her raise clear to everyone and what it is. So when he heard 12, he should have said 100 or 1,000 and then held up the action or whatever. But I mean, it was like boom, boom, bang, bang, you know, like a play at first base or something. It was so quick that it almost happened. It didn't, but it almost did. So I'm assuming that it's going to be that, and I'll probably will ask Jody to weigh in on it. But it was so weird. And then I guess a few hands later, it was a lot more than that, but much later on, I just wanted to talk to you about my elimination hand. And it was the same lady. There was this lady who had a tell, and it goes back to what Martha was talking about with the stereotypes. And I didn't pick up on Ertel until later on, and I got to expose it later. But she would limp, then call a raise, and then bet out no matter what. And it took me a few times because she was in the big blind when I was in the small blind, so we were battling all day. And it took me a while that when I was on the button and would raise her blind, because whether I was stealing or not, she would call the raise no matter what it was. And then when the flop came, she'd bet out. And everyone would fold to her because they would all think, oh, she's a woman. She doesn't know what she's doing.
Right.
So she must have a hand. I'm folding. But I wasn't thinking that. I just happened to have rags every time I tried to steal from her. But then I saw someone else play back at her. And I'm like, okay, I've noticed now that every time someone plays back at her, she folds. So she doesn't really have a hand. I think she's doing it. So it turned out that's what it was. So it was nice to actually pick up a tell on somebody and use it against them. But the woman next to her and I got into a hand. I had gone all in a bunch of times, short stacked. I had been stuck around that 16,000 for a while. I'd get it up to like 24 and then keep coming down. So I looked down at, as the first to enter the pot, so I looked down at ace, queen of clubs, and my M was like 4 or something. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm going with it. So I got it all in, and this lady took a while, and she's thinking about it and thinking about it. Finally, she calls, and everyone else folds. And I'm like, sweet. You know, I got a caller with ace, queen, and I could double up here and really be back in the tournament. She turns over ace of diamonds, queen of spades. And I'm like, woohoo, I'm free rolling. And, of course, I said I'm free rolling and totally jinxed myself as it comes spade, 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 spade. Drawing dead on the turn. I am absolutely not only the favorite, but I'm free-rolling, and I lose. And I thought to myself, and I took it like a gentleman. I stood up and said, nice playing with everybody. Good luck to everyone. And then went back to the hotel room.
I cried.
and bawled my eyes out. But it makes sense to me now why people tell bad beat stories. I know everyone hates to hear them, yet they all tell them. And it's so traumatic when it's the hand that knocks you out is a bad beat. You know, if you get knocked out, you have tens and queens like the hand I talked about earlier with Frank. You know, hey, he had the best hand. I deserve to go home. I'm going home. But when it's ace-queen suited versus ace-queen offsuit and you lose to the offsuit, it's like having aces versus aces and losing to a flush. It was just so brutal. And now I can empathize with people who tell bad beat stories when it's the one that knocked them out. You know, like the hand where I lost with the open-ended straight flush draw or whatever, hey, you know, the just very insistent didn't hit me when it was supposed to. I was 50-50 on the flop and then got progressively worse after that. But hey, you take it with the good with the bad or whatever. I'm not bitching about it. But that ace-queen hand, I can see why people tell bad beat stories now.
Well, there's something about the universe is out of kilter when an underdog hand like that knocks you out. And it seems like your whole world is turned upside down.
I mean, the one way to beat me on that one hand, it just happens to come four spades. It's just like you said, it's like the stars are lining up against you in that one instance, and you're just not meant to win that tournament or win to cash or whatever. And oh, man, it was so brutal. And if I win that hand, I'm right back in that tournament. And, you know, who knows what I'm doing because I had the whole table down. Clearly, I was doing well at the table. I just got one bad beat, you know.
Poor Chris.
But just some quick stuff afterward. Before the tournament started, I ran into one of our listeners, Mike. I had run into him last year. And he came up to me again. He's like, remember me? And I'm like, yes, I do remember you. And he's kind of like skeptical. And I'm like, no, I remember you. We were right over there. And he had a bandana on, and we were talking, and so he's like, okay, all right, so you remember me, so I got some questions for you. I thought it was hilarious. I had one of the listeners of the show came up to me with a list of, like, 20 questions, like he was interviewing me about the show, and my favorite question, I had two favorite questions. One of them was, hey, where were you really in this all-in poker movie? Now, I don't know if you knew this or not, but we had the director and moneymaker on the show recently, because of this documentary, All In, the poker movie.
Right.
And around 44 minutes into the movie, you can see me in the movie. And so I gave the director some crap about my name not being in the credits, and I need to get a SAG card and all this stuff, you know, joking around. So he's like, all right, where were you in the movie? And I'm like, I think it's about 44, 45 minutes in. He's like, all right, we're going to find out. And he pulls out his iPod, and he's got the movie on his iPod, and or his iPhone, and he's like, all right, here we go. And I'm like, oh, my God, he doesn't believe me. I'm telling you, I'm in the movie. Now, it took a while for us to find it because of the way it scrubbed when you were, you know, and it's a phone, you know, so, but sure enough, he froze it, and there's my ugly mug right in the middle of the screen, and he takes like a picture of it, you know, he did a caption thing where you could do with those phones where you hit the buttons at the same time. So now he's taking a photo of it, and he's put it on his phone, and then he cropped it so you can see my ugly face, and he's like, all right, I have proof right here that you were in the movie in case nobody believes you. So I started laughing, and then he says to me, you know, you talked about, you listened to the show last week, so I think we talked about the home game and how Scott had bluffed. Was that last week? Or before?
Yeah. He bluffed both you and Mark.
And Gambit, yeah. So he talked about that. He says, hey, you talked about Scott's great bluff and how you couldn't call him and everything. And here I am thinking we're going to get into this huge philosophical thing about bluffing and everything, right? And I'm like, I'm preparing my brain for this conversation. And he says, but you never said if Scott lost at the end of the night. Because Scott had like really like just towers of condominiums of chips in front of him after the first hour. So I just said to him, Mike, I really don't like to beat a man when he's down. I've learned that lesson the hard way at Binion's in Las Vegas in 2007. So I decided that I will never beat a man down when he's losing. Yeah, Scott didn't win in that home game again, and he starts laughing.
Oh, my God.
But I couldn't believe it. That was, like, the most important thing to him was to find out if Scott had won or lost in that game. But he had a bunch of questions for me, and I just – it's one of my favorite things is when I'm out representing Annie up the show or the magazine, people talking to us about the show, and I start to feel like the mayor of Daytona Beach Kennel Club because I've gone there so many times for these things. People come up to me and talk to me, and it's tough when I don't remember their name because – it's easier to remember someone's name when you see them in the magazine, and you just have to remember one person when they remember me. But for me to remember them for a five-second conversation that I had 3 years ago with them, it's tough. And I did remember Mike, though, so that I felt good about that. And I talked to a lot of people, so it was pretty cool.
Well, you give back, Chris.
I do. I'm very generous with my time. We actually talked for, like, at least a half an hour, and then we chatted a little more. And he was wearing the patch that we gave him, the Antioch Magazine patch, and he said it was good luck, so I gave him another one. Because he had sewn that one into his shirt. So I said, anybody who sews our patch into their shirt and wears it for us deserves my time. So I had a good time talking to him, and he made me laugh a lot. So, but a couple of more quick things. The room we stayed in, I swear to God, was in the Twilight Zone. The room itself. I don't know about anywhere else, but the room we stayed in at this resort was in the Twilight Zone. Okay, here's a couple things that happened. I go to turn the TV on, and the remote won't work. This happens every time I get into a hotel, anything, no matter what, it doesn't work. And we end up calling downstairs, and they send the person up, and the person says, oh, the wire is loose, or whatever it is. Yeah. So I decided to take it upon myself, and look, and there's this little, and you know how when you're in the hotels, their menu always comes up first? They have that override thing?
Right.
Well, the override sensor was, like, pointed the wrong way. So that's why TV wouldn't come on. So I fixed it. I moved the sensor and turned TV on. So TV comes on. I'm like, all right, that's cool. So at the end of the night, I was there with Jean, my wife. She came with me. At the end of the night, I always watch TV. She falls asleep. I watch TV at night. Same thing at the house. And there's no sleep timer on this damn thing. It says sleep, but it doesn't work. So I'm like, all right, whatever. So what I did was, instead of getting out of bed and waking her up and everything by accident, I decided I'll just turn it all the way down on mute, and because I couldn't turn the TV off. The sleep timer wouldn't work, and that off button would not work no matter what I did. So I just turned it all the way down. Next morning, Gene's like, you know, you left TV on all night. And I said, yeah, I know. I couldn't turn it off, and I didn't want to get out of bed and wake you up and whatever. And she's like, all right, well, let's turn it off now. And I'm like, well, I can't turn it off. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I don't know. It won't turn off. So when she stands up, I hit the off button, and it turns off. I'm like, how did that happen? Did it, like, bounce off of you or something, the signal? I mean, what? So she's like, I don't know. So I put the – Mike, I swear to God, I put the remote down. She walks away into the bathroom. The TV comes back on. I didn't touch the remote. It was, like, 7 seconds later. okay? The TV comes back on, and again now I can't turn it off again. Gene's in the other room now. I can't turn it off. She comes back in the room. I can turn it off. This is the truth. It was the craziest thing. So she's like, all right, well, I'm going to take a shower. I said, all right, you take a shower, and I'll wait for you, and then whatever. And so she's like, all of a sudden I hear cursing. And I'm like, what's going on, hon? What's the matter? She goes, this damn shower, it's getting hotter and hotter, and I can't turn it colder. It won't. So I'm like, oh, my God. So what's the matter? She's like, oh, wait, I got it now. I'm like, okay. So a couple minutes later, she's done with her shower, and she's like, I can't turn the water off. I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, the water won't turn off. She goes, I have it all the way cranked to the right, but the water just keeps coming out. I'm like, hon, I don't know what's going on, but maybe you just don't know how to run a shower, you know? She's like, I know how to run a shower. So I go in there, and it turns out that the person, quote, before us that was in the shower, Gene won't ever admit that she did this, so the handle was almost completely off of the inside hardware. So even though she was spinning the handle, it wasn't spinning the plastic thing that's in the wall that would turn the water off.
Right.
So I got in there and I'm like, I crank it as tight as I can so that I know it's flush against the wall and I know it's working. So I get it to work, and but sure enough, at the beginning, I couldn't get it to work either. So when I got it fixed, I'm like, well, I'm gonna tell the hotel I fixed their shower, and I'm gonna submit a bill. So anyway, you think that that's the end of the story, but I get out to the room, we get dressed, we're packing up, we're getting ready to go, and I look at my phone, and my phone says right on it, no SIM card. Now I'm like, I look at my phone, I look at the SIM card, the SIM card's still there. It says no SIM card, okay? This is the truth. So I turn the phone off, turn it back on, no SIM card. Now, I know I have a SIM card. I can see it, but I don't know what's going on. So I'm like, well, I'll figure it out later. We're going to check out. We grab our bags, turn all the lights off, get outside of the door. I get outside the door. As soon as the door closes, look at my phone. I have a signal, and it doesn't say no SIM card. This is the truth.
That room
was in the Twilight Zone.
Oh, so wow.
We get into the car. We start driving. Now, after the Daytona thing, we were so close to Jacksonville that I thought, you know, it's an hour and a half away. Scott said, hey, why don't you go up and see the new room, the brand new Best Bet Jacksonville facility. Well, we heard it was dynamite. Let's go see it. So I'm like, okay. We get out there. We get on the road, and we're going to get some breakfast first. We have some breakfast. I notice on the TV a news bulletin comes on, and it says I-95 North shut down. And I'm like, oh my God, we have to get on I-95 North. Where is it shut down? I start panicking, you know. So I grab my phone, which no longer says no SIM card, and I go on their website, because it says go for more information, go to clickorlando.com or whatever. So I go on their site, and it turns out that a massive beer truck had turned over and spilled like 40,000 gallons of beer on the highway. And at that moment, I thanked God that Scott was not on the trip with me, because I had visions of him sucking the asphalt like Peter Griffin and Family Guy and us not ever getting to Jacksonville.
Oh, wow.
So I decided to take the Route 1 until I went far enough up north that I can get back on 95. And the sign says, Jacksonville, 68 miles. And I'm like, well, that's not too bad. I'll get there like in an hour if it's 68 miles. This is great, you know. So about 5 minutes later, the next sign says, Jacksonville, 86 miles. Now, I had just driven 5 minutes more north, closer to my destination, yet I somehow lost 18 miles in this twilight zone that is Daytona Beach. I drive another 10 minutes, and I see a sign that says, Jacksonville, 73 miles. So I'm like, all right, someone's lying somewhere. I don't know where else. Now, I know you drive around a lot, or you travel a lot, but have you driven a lot around a lot in Florida? Like, have you been through, like, 95 and 75 and all these major roads, or do you just basically do all your traveling by air and go elsewhere?
It's been a while since I used to drive down to Miami and the Keys now and then.
Okay, but
and
never really north or?
North?
Drive north?
Not so much north.
Well, This is something that Scott would appreciate if you haven't seen these then. When Scott and I go for these road trips or go to visit our clients in the north and we drive, inevitably on the highway, there are always these signs that always say, life starts at, 14 days. Heartbeat begins after 7 days. Don't have an abortion. It's the Bible Belt.
Right.
And it's like sign after sign after sign. So Gene and I are driving, and I'm like, hun, right about now, you're going to start seeing all these abortion signs. And you're not going to believe how many of them there are. It's remarkable. And we're driving along, and every sign was bag of fruit for a buck. And I'm like, did bag of fruit buy out the abortion clinic and put up their own signs? Where are all these abortion signs that I know are here every time we make this trip? And then I'm getting nervous because I'm like,
Where am I?
And also, like, first it was don't have an abortion. Now there's these bags of fruit. What is going on? And then I was going to bring it up on the show with Scott. And then I realized it would be his opportunity to call me an ass and say you're an idiot because that's 75. When you go up 75, you see all those signs. I was going up 95. So apparently on the east coast of the state, they like their fruit in a bag.
Yeah.
But on the central part and even maybe the west coast, they want to make sure you don't get an abortion. So that was the trip there. And then when I got to Jacksonville, just real quickly, the facility is remarkable. It's 70 poker tables, massive structure, and they have space on the right that is almost as big as where they have the 70 poker tables on the left, and it's all empty. It's remarkable. They are ready for either slots, table games. The World Poker Tour puts their set there when they do their World Poker Tour stop there. Really, pretty much state of the art everything. They still have their great sushi, and the room was amazing. They have those. Have you ever been to like a banquet facility, like go for a wedding or something, and they have those partition doors that they can open or close to make the hall bigger? They have those there. Of course, they're brand new, state of the art, so you'd have no idea that's what that wall is. And then the manager there, Deb Jardine, took me inside, and she's like, here, look back here. And I'm like, oh my god, there's more. And sure enough, there are like another 20 tables in another whole room that you didn't even know that room was there because you thought it was a wall. And she could have opened it up and made the whole floor all 70 tables, so they have a high limit area. So it was worth the trip to go up there and see it. And overall, it was a lot of fun. And I felt like I was in the Twilight Zone from losing with Ace Queen of Clubs versus Ace Queen off to having no SIM card and the TV doing whatever it wanted to. So, but anyway, that was my Scott Long impression of talking about stuff that has nothing to do with poker.
I could picture you in that hotel room going berserk.
Oh my god, it was crazy. It was a nice place though, very nice place, and we were happy with it. It was just, oh my god, those three things just drove us nuts.
Hi, this is Team Poker Stars Pro Vanessa Russo, and you are listening to the Ante Up PokerCast.
You gotta fight for your right to win.
Okay, so what I want to do is I want to bring up a hand that happened during the tournament, and I was not involved, but it was Chris Moneymaker's hand. And I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm going to make you me this week, and you tell me how you would have taken care of this. So all right, let's set it up. As we know now, it's a charity tournament, and it, like I said, it wasn't a terribly big buy-in, especially if you pre-registered. So it's not like there's a ton of money on the line here, but the final result, if you made the final table, is like, a Venetian deep stack sort of package and stuff. So it's worth it. It's a rebuy tournament too. But mostly, the most important part of all this is that most of these players, or a lot of them at least, are supporting their charity by being there. They're not real poker players. So that's what you could be up against, or what you could be in this case. So a couple of hours in at his table, there are about four limpers, including the hero, and the hero has King Jack. Okay, so that's you. You have King Jack. And now it gets to Chris Moneymaker in the big blind. We won't deal with specific chip counts or numbers other than percentages or at least the amounts. So there are four limpers when it gets to him in the big blind, and he raises now to 5X.
Okay.
It folds around to you with King Jack. What do you do? Now, you've already limped. Now, I realize as a tight player and in the position that this person was in, you may have already folded the hand, but you have to play it as if you're in this situation now. You have King Jack. He makes it 5X. There are three limpers worth of dead money, and you're with King Jack, and you're out of position. What do you do?
Right. Well, as I say before, if I was going to play this hand, I probably would have come in for a raise.
Right.
If I was going to play it at all, I would not have limped. Given that I have limped and he's raised to 5X, assuming now that I can get him, I would be heads up with him.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is that you're not out of position. You're actually,
you're actually in position
because he's in a big blind.
And I would probably... I'd probably just call here.
You would call. Okay. That's exactly what the hero does. With King Jack offsuit, she calls. The flop comes 5-5 deuce, and you're heads up with a world champion who now bets 2/3 of that pot. And it doesn't affect your stack size yet. You still have a pretty decent stack size. So what do you do? 5-5 deuce, he bets 2/3 of the pot.
Well, as I see it...
You clear your throat.
I clear my throat. Realistically, I have two options here. I can fold, or I can raise.
Right.
I don't believe I'm going to call this bet and take another card and try to hit something. I'm not real happy with this. I'm happy with this flop, I guess, because I'm not thinking that this flop has hit him. I'm not playing this as myself, really. I'm playing this as a hero. I think I would probably raise him here.
So you would raise because you didn't believe him? Is that what you're saying? That you don't think that he had a pocket pair, and that he's not good here, and that no matter what he has, as long as it's not a pair or a piece of this, that a raise would get him off his hand?
I think I'm trying to raise him here to make him fold. I don't think this flop has hit him, and I'm not buying. I'm not buying that he has a hand to start with.
Really. Okay, now you had said that. You had two options.
Yeah, the other one would be to fold.
Fold and then or raise. So,
or raise.
Is there, since you don't believe him, is there an option now to call and then, because you're floating, as they say, and then taking it away from the turn? Because if you don't believe him and he doesn't fire on the turn, he checks, then you can take it from him? Or do you just absolutely think call is a big mistake?
Well, I'm not a fan of... I like calling when I'm... This is just me. I like calling when I've got some kind of draw.
Yeah.
You know.
And also water is wet.
I would call with a draw here if I had hit either a king or a jack, or if I whiffed. I like raising here.
Okay.
I just don't like calling. I'm going with Lee's perspective on this. I like coming in for a raise. I don't like calling.
Okay.
I want to take control of the hand. I want to push him off this hand, and basically either that or I'm gonna fold it.
Okay. So, not that we have specifics here or anything, but he made a bet. So when you raise him, if you did raise him, you'd make it what, three times his bet?
Probably not that much.
A little.
If
more.
He raised 2/3 of the pot, I would probably. I'd probably not min raise him, but I would probably like do it 2.5 times.
So almost three times then. So 2.5 times. Okay. Well, here's what happens. The hero thinks for a little while, then she calls.
All right.
So we're still heads up. Some decent money in the pot now because he bet 2/3 pot. She called it.
Right.
So there's a pretty decent pot brewing. The turn is another 5. So now it's 5-5, deuce, 5. Chris Moneymaker bets now half the pot, which, by the way, is about half of your stack now at this point. What do you do?
Wow.
So you didn't, remember, you didn't raise. and he didn't call. It's more you have to be in their shoes.
Yeah.
You just called his bet, and now he's bet again into you. Now it's half the pot, and it's 5-5, deuce 5.
And that half the pot represents half of my stack.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the 5 coming out, of course, means it's less likely that he has a 5 in his hand, mm-hmm. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Ace high beats me here.
Mm-hmm.
I would have loved to have raised him on the flop,
right,
instead of just called him. If I had raised him on the flop and he had re-raised me, I would have been able to fold easily and gotten away from this hand, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah, of course you could have. I mean, King Jack with no draw, no nothing, you
yeah,
could have gotten away from it.
But since I just called him, I've let him continue to take the lead in the hand. I'm going to have a hard time calling the half my stack with nothing here.
Okay.
If it's me, I wouldn't have been to this point, but right, I probably folded here.
You would fold. So I agree. I think that I would have folded, and I'm not sure how I would have played this from the beginning to end, but in this point, yes, I would have folded. Our hero thinks again, long, and then calls.
All right.
The river is the case 5 for a board of 5-5, deuce 5-5.
Well, as I said, it wasn't in his hand, so I was right about that.
Moneymaker shoves. What do you do?
Well, you can beat queen high here.
Yeah, you can beat queen high. That's correct.
You have the... actually, you have the second nut hand here, right?
The second nuts.
At this point, when I see that fourth five come off,
uh-huh,
that actually induces me to call this hand.
Okay. So... now you think that your hand is good.
I think I'm good here.
You're good, and you're gonna call your tournament life.
I think
king,
any pocket
king high
pair that he has has now been counterfeited, and any queen high or lower hand is dead. I have the second nuts. I think I have I put so much into this now that it's too late to go back. I will definitely, if I'm in this spot, I definitely call the river.
Okay, well, here's what you should have done. The hero turns to the dealer and says, "The only thing that could beat a king right now is an ace, right?"
Oh, my God.
The dealer, of course, doesn't answer her.
Right.
And says, "I can't tell you, it's your move," or whatever.
Yeah.
After a few moments, she's thinking and thinking, and she calls the all-in of Chris Moneymaker, who is now crippled, who, of course, was bluffing on a open-ended straight draw with 3-4 in his hand.
Oh, my God.
So, very interesting. He had an open-ended straight draw on the flop, then represented on the turn, and really represented on the end that he had, like, ace-deuce. You know, because ace-deuce makes sense, too. He could raise 5X with ace-deuce, have deuces and fives on the flop, makes his boat on the turn, and then shoves with an ace-kicker. You know, that hand makes sense to me, but it's like it's so finite that I don't know if I had the nuts to call there like that. I don't know if I would have been able to do that with just a king high, but interesting hand, the way it went up and down like that. I mean, again, I agree with you. If I'm going to play king jack, I'm playing it for a raise if I'm first into the pot, and then I think I'm I think I'm folding it when he makes it 5X preflop anyway. King jack, it's a rookie hand, they call it.
Yeah,
you know,
I would
crushed.
I would have come in for the raise. Now, if I had played it the way she did and limped and called the raise on the flop when he bets out, I would have definitely, with a flop like 5-5 deuce, I would have definitely popped him there instead
yeah.
of just called.
Yeah, absolutely.
I would have taken it away from him or tried to at some point in the hand, as I said throughout. But once you get into that position at the end, I think you're looking at the second nuts. I think you're pretty much obligated to call at that point.
So now you can tell everybody in the home game and all your friends that you called a world champion with king high and won. Okay, well, obviously, this is just a hand that I found, so there's no swag for this. But if you send in your hand of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, you might win something really cool, like the Grinder Bracelet from Pro Poker Gear, which sells much more than terrific bracelets for home games or leagues, including hats, T-shirts, and gifts in the AnteUp store at AnteUpStore.com. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today. It was great to have you back.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Chris. Good to talk to you.
And don't forget, Scott will be back in 2 weeks, and fingers crossed that Lee Childs will be my co-host next week. If not, I might be talking to myself for an hour and a half. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Mike Fasso.
And we'll see you at the table.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
Bloody stool. Up from my throne I spy this bloody stool, mute and red like a disapproving stare. O viscous smudge of doom, why are you there? It's been years since with health I played the fool. Sweet youth was time for breaking every rule. Cigarettes, sin, beer gobbled without care. And now in this bowl, the result laid bare, seasoned by my tears, or is it my drool? Fond memories of last night's banquet meats curdle this morn in my sick lesioned guts, and death is foretold neath cold hospice sheets. But as I muse on that fine feast, those treats, hark! Salvation springs from my poor brain's ruts, and haply I see that side dish of beets. It's called Bloody Stool.
Oh my God, you've fallen victim to the Scott Long. I mean, how is that poker? You usually do a sonnet about poker or something.
Well, here's the thing. This was done in a pure sonnet form.
Uh-huh.
If you go back and you look at it, every line has 10 syllables.
Yep.
Every rhyme is in the A, B, A, B, A, A, B, or whatever the
right.
C, C, D, C.
Yeah.
Four lines, three lines, three lines. And the whole point of the thing is you do the first eight lines, sets up the problem, and then the last six lines solve the problem. So obviously, I think I'm dying of rectal cancer because I have a bloody stool. And then at the end, I remember that I had beets last night. And that's the cause of the bloody stool. So it's kind of a salvation story. I don't know that it has anything to do with poker, but there you have it.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, oh, man, I'm out of the tournament. Oh, wait, we have the same hand.
Yeah, right.